Magnify the Lord with me. Let us exalt his name together. It is Tuesday, May 12th, 2020. We had a glitch yesterday, so the morning program didn't air properly, but it did get broadcast in the evening. So you know for Memorization Monday, we covered Ephesians 5:18, which stated, "Do not get drunk on wine, which leads to debauchery. Instead, be filled with the Spirit." And so that was covered yesterday. And if you missed it, please stop by our website, greatnewsradio.org, under our archived programs link, as besides learning about that verse and how to be filled with the Spirit, I also dedicated 4 songs to moms, and I don't want you to miss out on us honoring you. Also, I mentioned today and tomorrow's program was going to be a message by Becky Pippert from 1989, 31 years ago, delivered during Founders Week. And so you'll hear that recording in just a moment. And not only will you be blessed by her message on evangelism and the importance of sharing your faith, but I'm going to have Becky live next week as we'll talk about her new book, Stay Salt, The World Has Changed, Our Message Must Not, for Testimony Tuesday. So to get primed to hear her next week, here's her message from 1989 titled, What Difference Does Faith in God Make?
One of the things that happened to me is I, particularly in the former days when I used to travel a great deal, is I would be on a plane and sit down next to someone, and inevitably they would say, "What do you do for a living?" And I would always tell them. And then their response usually told me a great deal more about them than it did about me. Now, I don't know if this happens to you, where you start talking to somebody and they think you're normal, and then they find out, you know, that you're not. We will assume that is because you are a believer and that there are no other reasons why they think you're abnormal. And this continually happens to me, but it's one thing to be a Christian. It's another thing to do it for a living. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of embarrassing. And so I was flying one time from New York to California, and I sat down on the plane right next to a man from Southern California. Now, he was your quintessential Southern California type. He had the open collar, the obligatory gold chains. He had everything but the feathers, if you know what I mean. He was, in a word, mellow. So we're talking, and it's really laid back, and he says, "Hey, by the way, what do you do for a living?" And I said, "Well, I'm in Christian work." He said, "That's cool." "I'd never hold it against you." I said, "Well, how kind. Thank you very much." A little bit later, I was flying back from California, seated next to a New Yorker. Everything changed. I felt like I was hanging on by my fingertips. The guy was so intense. He was so verbose. He looked so nervous, like the stock market reported yet again had crashed. And all of a sudden he said, "What do you do for a living?" I said, "I'm in Christian work." He said, "That's impossible." I said, "Why?" He said, "You look normal." And I said, "Well, no, actually, I do this." He said, "Wait a minute, wait a minute. You're in Christian work." I said, "Yes." He said, "Is this a marketable skill?" Now, to go from, "Hey, baby, that's cool," to, "Is it a marketable skill?" We have traversed many cultural miles, don't you think? However, a little bit later, I was in Texas. Now, I love Texans. I really do. But I was flying into a place called Lubbock, Texas. Have any of you ever heard of that song by Mac Davis called "Happiness is Lubbock, Texas in a Rearview Mirror"? You have to think about it. Yeah. That song takes on more significance once you land in Lubbock, if you know what I mean. So I'm on this little commuter plane, and there are like about 5 men who have their Wall Street Journals, and they're all real East Coast types. And I came in and I sat down next to the only woman on the plane, and it turned out she was from Lubbock. So we started talking, and it was just, you know, she's a lovely person. When she said, "What do you do for a living?" And I said, "Well, I'm in Christian work." And she said, "Oh, honey, that's sweet." She said, "That is the sweetest thing." She said, "I want you to sit here right now." Like I wasn't really going to step, you know, off the plane. And she turns, to my horror, to every man on that plane and said, "Y'all, excuse me just a minute, but I just wanted you to know this little girl over here works for Jesus." Everybody looked over at me. Everybody put down their Wall Street Journals, and I went, "Hi." Oh, well, yeah, what can I say? It's a living, you know what I mean? However, as I try and listen, beneath the questions, after the initial shock about what I do for a living, I have found almost to a person the same question keeps emerging. And you know what it is? Once they begin to trust me, what they really want to know is, Becky, does it really make a difference to believe in God? After this last year that we have spent in Christendom, do you really think it makes a difference to believe in God? If it does, we haven't seen much. And that is the question that I want to begin to address this morning. What difference does faith in God make? My husband, Wes, was a fellow at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. And it enabled me as a spouse to take any class I wanted for free. This is about 2 years ago. And so one day I began talking to a professor there. And the professor said, you know, I'm very impressed that you and Wes are so devout. But I need to ask you a question. Do you really think, in the end, it makes a difference, whether you believe in God or not? He said, Becky, isn't life the same? Isn't the experience of life the same? Don't all of us try to make sense and meaning out of our lives? Don't all of us want to be included? We want to be recognized. We want to be a part. Don't all of us try to find love and intimacy? I said, yes, that's true. He said, whether you believe in God or not, I said, whether you believe in God or not, that's true. The emotions, the experience of life, essentially, is not that different. He said, and let me ask you this. Isn't life difficult for all of us? He said, don't Christians die of cancer, get depressed, have money problems? Don't you, the way that we do, try to raise our kids the best we can, and some make it and some don't, leaving us crushed and broken? I said, yes, that's true. Life is difficult whether you believe in God or not. And he said, and Becky, don't Christians fail morally? He says, I grant you, you do better in some areas than we do. But I tell you the truth, I've seen my share of Christian racists and gluttons and self-righteous. I said, and he said, and don't tell me they weren't real Christians. I said, oh, I believe you. He said, so Christians fail. I said, yes, we do. He said, well, then you tell me. If the experience of life is essentially the same, if life is equally difficult, and if you fail, what difference does it make to believe in God? That is the question I am convinced that we have to be able to answer now more than ever before. What difference does it make? You know, there's a lot of talk these days about our need for mentors, that we need people who embody qualities that we aspire towards. It's not enough just to appreciate goodness and truth and integrity. We need to see these qualities in people. And that, of course, is true. So we need visible role models. And yet, think about it. Who were the visible role models in 87 and in 88? In business, it was Ivan Boesky. In politics, it was Gary Hart. And in religion, it was Jimmy Swaggart and Jimmy Baker. Now, that's pretty sobering. But even more sobering is every single one I've mentioned, except for Boesky, at some point in their life confessed Jesus Christ as Lord. They all came from evangelical roots except Boesky. But when push came to shove, what difference did it make? It didn't seem to make a difference at all. Furthermore, we're living in crazy times. I think we're living in times where the church all too often preaches the world's message and the world produces surprising prophets. For example, Wes was a senior Middle East correspondent for UPI, and we lived in Jerusalem for 3 years, had our first child there, Elizabeth. And then we went to Harvard for the sabbatical. So we've only been back in Washington for a year, and it feels like we've been overseas for about 5 years, and we hadn't watched television. So you may be more accustomed to this than I am, but when we got back to Washington and turned on the television, it was shocking to me to see on Sunday morning, not every station, I don't say that, and yet it was shocking to see how often I heard a gospel preached on television that kind of went like this: you deserve the best, you only go around once in life, so get all the gusto you can for the glory of God. And someone said, it's a statement about theology and it's a statement about beer. It's lousy beer and even worse theology. And yet we find surprising prophets from the secularists. The Doonesbury cartoonist Gary Trudeau said in a commencement speech 10 years ago, we live in an age where people would rather be envied than esteemed. And when that happens, God help us. Ellen Goodman, who writes for the Boston Globe, did an article this year and called The Goodness of Guilt. Meg Greenfield in Newsweek did the possibility of moral absolutes and the no-fault confession of 1987. Perhaps Ted Koppel was the most amazing of all, who in his address at Duke last year said, "We have actually convinced ourselves that slogans will save us. Shoot up if you must, but use a clean needle. Enjoy sex whenever and with whomever, but wear a condom." No. The answer is no. Not because it isn't cool or smart or because you might end up in jail or dying in an AIDS ward, but no, because it is wrong. Because we have spent 5,000 years as a race of rational human beings trying to drag ourselves out of the primeval slime by searching for truth and moral absolutes. In its purest form, truth is not a polite tap on the shoulder. It is a howling reproach. What Moses brought down from Mount Sinai were not the 10 suggestions. What's going on here? Why can we turn the Sunday dial and hear a beer commercial? And why are these men and women giving us biblical truth? What's happened? How did we get into this situation? Does God make a difference? I want to say to you with every fiber of my being that God through Jesus Christ makes all the difference. But the difficulty is we've tried to pin that difference in the wrong areas. And then in the tremendous area where he makes a difference, I think we've been very lax. Does God make a difference? Yes, he does. But in order to experience the mystery and the marvel of the change of God through his grace, you have to face the mess. You can't experience the mystery unless you face the mess. What's the mess? The mess is the human heart. The mess is the problem of sin. And the solution is the grace of God through the forgiveness and cleansing and renewing that Jesus Christ offers. What is the problem with the human heart? What's the problem with the human condition? G.K. Chesterton said it as succinctly as anyone years ago in Britain when they were asking, the London Times says, "We want all of you to write an essay on what is the problem in the universe today." And evidently they just got these massive documents in the mail. G.K. Chesterton on a single sheet of paper sent in, "What is the problem with the universe?" "I am. Sincerely, G.K. Chesterton." Chesterton also said, "You know, I find it amazing that moderns reject the doctrine of original sin when it is the only Christian doctrine that can be empirically verified." We have forgotten what the problem is and what the solution is. Furthermore, we live in a culture that hasn't faced the mess either. We have this remarkably Boy Scout attitude about human nature, and we go around assuming that we're basically wonderful people who occasionally do bad deeds. Consequently, we're always shocked by sin instead of being staggered by grace. Do you know, in our history, even as recently in American history as the framing of the Constitution, they didn't have this sort of Boy Scout approach to human nature. Do you know why they wrote the American Constitution? Because they understood that human nature was treacherous, and we needed a document that would protect us from ourselves. Our culture, presently, is not very enlightened about the mess. Is the church? Frankly, I don't think so. I was listening to a primary choir sing a song not too long ago, and they were sort of taking an old song and making it a bit more modern, but there were all these 3-, 4-, and 5-year-olds up there, and they were singing a song that kind of went like this. "I was a sinner deep in sin, till the Lord took me in, deep, deep, deep in the miry pit." And remember, this one little 4-year-old just kept talking about sinking in the miry pit. And we all laughed. It was sort of ironically endearing to hear these little children singing words they didn't understand, until it hit me. Have we evidenced any more understanding of the human condition than these little children? Do we really understand what's wrong and what the problem is? When I was at Harvard with Wes, I took a graduate psychology class. And in that class one day, we broke up into small groups and they asked us to sort of talk about how we were going to apply the theoretical material to our lives. Now, it turned out that the class was 50% of them were therapists. So this has something to do, I think, with the way the conversation went. But do you know what they said? We were in these small groups, and I kept hearing people say, "All right, the problem is I'm jealous, or I feel hostile towards somebody, or I am so competitive." And I thought, why does this feel so strange? They just kept talking about the nature of their problem. I thought, why does this feel odd? I thought, I know why. It's because I'm usually with Christians. And the more that I listened to them, it was refreshing to see such honesty about admission of problem. The sad part is that it was clear they didn't know where to go for answers. Where do we get the power to change? 10 minutes after that class, I went to a Bible study. And you know what it was like? It was as dramatically different from that class at Harvard as I could imagine. Nobody had a problem. Everybody smiled. They all praised the Lord. I heard lots of promises, lots of biblical truth, all of which I agreed with. But not one problem was ever mentioned. If it was ever mentioned at all, it was about somebody else who needed prayer. And as I thought about the two groups, I thought it felt to me like one group had all the problems and no answers, and the second group had all the answers and no problems. Do you know what happens when you have all of the answers and no problems? Do you know what it sounds like? It sounds like happy talk. Hearty hail, but not very believable. Everybody presented themselves as finished products. And the tragedy is that I think they thought it would have been unspiritual to have acknowledged where they had a problem. It's tragic because spirituality only begins at the point of our problems. It only begins at the point of our weakness. Who has faced the mess? Well, I know some people who have faced the mess within. Usually it's people who've suffered, who have failed, who have been broken. I remember talking to an alcoholic once, a recovered alcoholic. And he said, I'll never forget the first time I went to an AA meeting. He said, Becky, I walked in the door, and the first thing I was aware of is that there was not one person who hadn't suffered. And they came and they told me that they had faced their utter inability to change who they were, that they had owned their problem. They also knew that they could not change their problem, but God could, and God could help me. And they felt that there was hope for me, and they embraced me as I was. And they told me that they felt that God could change me too. And he said, I felt like I had walked into a fellowship of the wounded, but the wounded and healed. And I said, Bob, that is the best description of what church is supposed to be I've ever heard of. And he laughed. And he said, oh, Becky, he said, in my real drunk days, I went to church. I was so desperate. And the message was kind but polite. Come back when you've got your act together. I said, why isn't the church like an AA meeting? And he said, because we really don't believe the problem is in us. We don't really believe the rot is in us too. The problem is out there, not in here. We're good and respectable. We sing hymns and smile. And we talk about being sinners, all the while secretly knowing we may be sinners, but we're not as bad as those jerks over there. So I began to ask myself, what breaks through denial? Do we have to become alcoholics in order to see our true condition? God forbid. Do you know what can help break through our denial without having to have the riotous living of those who have not known Christ? The cross breaks through our denial. Because while we're sitting there singing hymns, smiling sweetly, every Sunday morning, there is the naked cross standing there staring at us. That is what breaks through our denial, and it reveals to us our true condition. I want to look at the cross for a minute and say, what does the cross show us, and why does it give us hope? Because never forget the context of what I'm saying. God makes all the difference, and he wants to give us joy and hope and peace, and he wants to change us. We must never lose what it's all about. But my thesis this morning is that the only way that we can be changed into the glory and the marvel and the joy is we have to face the mess. He doesn't want us to look at the mess in order to make us feel bad. He wants us to look at the mess in order to make us feel better. What does the cross show us? You've got to keep two images in mind when you look at the cross. Jesus died and we crucified him. Jesus died and we were crucified with him. We crucified him and we were crucified with him. Both are central insights into understanding the cross. Let's take the first one. Jesus died and we crucified him. How does that help break through our denial and teach us? I was speaking several years ago at a very large conference, and after I spoke, there was a line of people that I was shaking hands with, and one woman came up and she was sobbing so hard that I finally took her away to a small room and said, what is the matter? It was hard to even get coherent sentences at first, and this was her story. She said, I'm married. We have four wonderful children. My husband's a pastor. God has blessed our ministry. When my husband and I were engaged, we were the youth leaders of a very large, wonderful church, very evangelical, very conservative, very godly. And the Lord clearly had blessed our ministry. And she said, it's hard for me to say this, but she said about in the last year of their engagement, we began to have sexual relations. She said, you cannot imagine the spiritual schizophrenia of knowing we were compromising, knowing we were failing at the very point where we were most trying to help our young people. But then we discovered I was pregnant. She said, Becky, the thought of taking that truth to that church where there had never been scandal was unthinkable. They could have never handled it. And I thought to myself, what a tragedy. A hospital who doesn't know how to care for the sick. However, she said something that was also true. She said, had we gone and told them, probably it would have been difficult at first, but we would have worked through it and we would have seen God redeem it. But I'll never know what would have happened, because the more we thought about how mortifying it was to go and tell them, the more we felt we only had one option left. I had an abortion. She said, my wedding day was the worst day of my life. She said, I went down the aisle and everybody was looking at me and smiling. And I said to myself, you're a murderer. You know who you are, and you know what you've done. You've murdered an innocent life. It was bad enough that you blew it the first time, but you covered that. And they may think you're sweet and innocent, but I know who you are, and so does God. She said, Becky, I know that God forgives, but I cannot experience it, and I cannot feel forgiven myself, and I do not know where to go with my guilt. I can't believe I could have ever killed an innocent life. I can't believe I am capable of murdering an innocent. And a thought came to me very strongly. But I thought, boy, if this is not from the Lord and I say it and it's wrong, I will destroy this woman. And she was right on the edge. So I didn't say anything. But she kept weeping and saying, I can't believe I could have ever murdered an innocent life. And so I took a deep breath, went out on a limb, and I said, my dear friend, this is not your first murder. It's your second. The cross shows all of us as murderers. We are all crucifiers, aborters or non-aborters, religious or irreligious. Do you think there is a sin you've committed that Jesus didn't die for? Do you think there's something that you did yesterday that didn't send Jesus to the cross? The cross is sufficient for all of history, past, present, and future. And Luther says, we carry his very nails in our pockets. So you have murdered an innocent already. And if you did it before, I'm just surprised that you're surprised that you could do it again. And it seems to me you have experienced more guilt over killing your own child than over killing God's son. And for the first time, she stopped crying abruptly. And she said, I cannot believe what you're telling me. All these years I've known Jesus died for my sins. Never did I really realize that I put the nails in. You're right. You are right. I have felt more guilt over killing my own son than over God's son. But she said, Becky, do you realize what you're telling me? I have come to you in total brokenness saying, I have done the worst thing any human being can ever do. I murdered my baby. And you're telling me I did something even worse than that? Now, I'm not sure that would qualify as one of the great counseling techniques, you know, of all times. And I said, yes, actually, that is what I'm saying. She said, do you realize then what the cross is telling me? She said, what the cross is saying is that it insists on highlighting my evil in order that I can know that it's been forgiven.
Wow, forgiveness that can be received through faith in the Lord Jesus Christ. God through Jesus Christ makes all the difference. You can't experience the mystery unless you face the mess. That was part of a message by Becky Pippert as delivered during Founders Week 1989. Tomorrow we'll pick right up where we left off, so I hope you can join me. Also, next Tuesday, we'll have Becky talk about her new book, Stay Salt. The world has changed, our message has not. Thanks for listening. Thanks for being a part of our radio listening family. This is Mark Burns with Great News Radio, a ministry of the Great News Media Group. God bless you and have a great day and night.